An al-Assad military base in Iraq has been attacked. Even though the Pentagon says one U.S. contractor has been dead, other sources put the number of U.S. contractors dead at 2 with 6 injured. In this debate, we will look at how and why U.S. forces are being targeted in Iraq and what this escalation could mean when it comes to heightened tensions between the United States and Iran. Our guest joining us, Brett Yonkers, is a historian and journalist who joins us from Hesselt. And we also have Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Elijah McNair, let me first start with you. You have a couple of sources that have two different stats on this. First source saying that 10 rockets were fired, one U.S. contractor dead. That was due to a cardiac arrest. And then you have another source that says you have two U.S. contractors who are dead as a result, with 6 injured. First of all, tell us what your reaction is to this and where this may lead to.
Thank you for having me. So the main point is not how many contractors has been killed in this attack or by heart attack or have been seriously injured or whatever. The main point is that the Iraqis are saying to the Americans, you need to leave the country. That is the main message. The attack was done from the area called al-Baghdadi, just a few kilometers away from Ain al-Assad military base, the largest American base. It is a Sunni area. The Americans started by bombing the Iraqi borders, killing a Sunni militant they called Iranian militia, which they got it completely wrong. They are Iraqi security forces who are on the borders protecting Iraq and preventing the crossing of ISIS from Syria to Iraq and hunting down ISIS in the desert. And the Americans started this new U.S. administration by Joe Biden, started by killing Iraqis. That is his first act of war and aggression, and it is not allowed for the Americans to carry attacks in Iraq because they are supposed to train the Iraqis. And the parliament asked them to leave, and they still there, and they don't want to leave. It is up to the Iraqi resistance to react. And when the Americans were in the country 2003 and occupied Iraq, when Al-Qaeda and other groups were attacking the Americans, they never went to bombard and kill the Iraqi forces. Why are they doing that? They are trying to create a war between the Americans and the majority Shia in the country, when Hashdi Shaabi is not made of Shia, it's made of Shia, Sunni, Kaldanian. All the composition and the bouquet of the Iraqi society, and the Americans insist in calling them Iranian militia, and these people are saying to the Americans, leave the country. That is the message.
Well, Brett Yonkers, we're looking at the 10 rockets that were fired on this Ain al-Assad air base, and according to one of the sources, these were used by the local Iraqi resistance groups in the years 2006 to 2010, that these were those groups that were fighting against the occupation forces, as they were called. So this distinction needs to be made over here. What type of message is this sending, aside from the obvious one that obviously they want U.S. forces out?
Well, I think there is not really much else to be said, I think, except for the fact indeed that the Iraqis are fed up with everything, and that they are fed up with the occupation in any possible way, shape, or form, even if this comes in a way in a claim of an American claim of fighting Daesh, fighting Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. Indeed, as has been pointed out, I don't have that much to add to it in this regard, that it is very clear that the Iraqi people across ethnicities, across sectarian divides, across religious divides, even Muslim and non-Muslim and like, are fed up with the U.S. arrogance and the U.S. occupation and the murderous tendencies that the United States has been displaying in Iraq ever since 2003. And it is starting to get to really wear down, I think, on the Iraqi people, and even, I think, on the international community, especially, of course, in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, and across Western Asia, that these excuses that are being given, as well that we have seen today when the Americans, the British and the Danish, who incidentally also had two people in this base, are immediately pulling the card of saying, oh, you know, if you attack our forces, what you are doing is de facto siding with Daesh and Al-Qaeda because we are there to fight Daesh. This is really such a tired and ridiculous argument in a time when Daesh has been all but defeated and there's only some mopping up left to do. And the fact that they still are using this excuse at a moment when the Iraqis are more than capable nowadays, in cooperation with their actual allies, to mop up whatever resistance of terrorist forces is left, the fact that they still use this excuse is absolutely ludicrous. And I think this is something that has been that has been seen time and again. And we know for a fact that there are not some of these attacks that have happened in the past are not always necessarily traceable to Hashd al-Sha'abi. It is also, in some ways, these are militant groups that are not related to the popular mobilization units, but also in that other people, for example, Sunni groups that are either in Hashd al-Sha'abi or outside of it, who are just fed up with the fact that the Americans stay there. But we have to bear in mind, of course, indeed, as has been said, that the Joe Biden administration has killed an Iraqi serviceman and wounded several others in last week's criminal attack, bombing attack, what they claimed was in Syria, but according to some Iraqi sources was actually taking place on Iraqi soil near the border, and has in this way again violated the Iraq's territorial sovereignty, which has led groups such as Harakat al-Mujaba, which is of course part of the Hashd al-Sha'abi, to claim that whatever agreements of ceasefire they had with the occupation forces for the time being have been cancelled now, and this is the time of retaliation. And this retaliation is completely justifiable, especially, as we all know, because of the fact that the Iraqi parliament has demanded U.S. troops to leave. The fact that they haven't done that makes them an occupation force that is basically comparable to the occupation force right after the invasion of 2003, and as such, they are legitimate military targets.
I would think that it's a viable question to ask here, Elijah Magnier, a general one, and that is, why are U.S. forces on Iraqi soil? What purpose does Iraq serve for them? We know the stated goal at this point right now, based on what the Americans have said, is that they are fighting the Daesh forces. But is that what it is? Is that the reason why they are so keen on staying in Iraq?
Well, that's a very good question. No, they're not there to fight ISIS. They are there to prevent the connection between Iraq and Iran. They are there to prevent the connection between Iraq and Syria. They are there because of the oil. They are there to make sure that they have a base to that is near Iran, and they can use this base in case they want to declare war on Iran or they want to hit targets, as they did with General Soleimani in January 2020. They are not there to fight ISIS because the government declared ISIS defeated. And of course, ISIS has been defeated all over Iraq as an occupier of cities. The insurgency will remain and will always remain. The Americans never managed to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, notwithstanding 20 years of occupation. And they're not getting rid of Al-Qaeda in Syria. On the contrary, they financed Al-Qaeda in Syria. So it is not a question of terrorism. It's not a question of Al-Qaeda. It's a question of standing between those who reject the U.S. hegemony and the Middle East and wants the U.S. And they want to impose their will, and they want to impose their strength and their power over the population of Iraq. And Iraq is a very rich country of oil, one of the richest of oil. And the Americans always said, we want the oil. It doesn't mean they need the oil, but they want to control the energy. And who control the energy, control the world. And this is the aim of the Americans. And we see an increase of ISIS activity when the Iraqis start asking from the Americans to leave. Now we watch France stepping in and doing the dirty laundry of Joe Biden and saying ISIS is expanding in Iraq, and then Americans are saying ISIS is expanding in Syria to justify the presence of the Americans and some European countries in Iraq and in Syria. And what they are doing, they're blocking the commerce between Iraq and Syria to prevent the recovery of Syria. This is why they are in Iraq. They have multi-purposes, multi-objectives, and they all against the Middle East, and in particularly the people of Iraq and Syria.
Okay, you're looking at a week and weeks, Bret Yonkers, where you have had an uptick, an increase in U.S. forces and U.S.-backed forces or U.S.-led forces in Iraq to be targeted. You had what happened with that Erbil incident in which the U.S. as a result carried out an airstrike targeting what it seems to always be using, Iran-backed militias is what it says, in Syria. That was the first military action taken by Biden. Now, first of all, the response that came on this from Iran was, you know, you are now encouraging terrorism in the region because you have fighters there in the Syria who are fighting Daesh terrorists. So this goes back to the fact that how the U.S. either shields them, supports them indirectly, covertly. Do you agree with what Iran has said regarding that? And is it decision time for the U.S.? We know that under Biden now, the military offensive took place. And now with this past week's increase, is it time for the U.S. to start rethinking what it's doing in Iraq, or will it take a military approach like it did just 5 days ago?
It's always, of course, a big question when it comes to what the United States will do. And in that regard, it is interesting to see that the differences between and the differences and the similarities between Republicans and Democrats in that regard are always quite interesting, because as warmongering and aggressive as Donald Trump was, he is actually the person who has scaled back on the deployment in Iraq. And now under Joe Biden, the so-called, who was elected by some people, let's say, as the, let's say, anti-war candidate, we see an increase in aggressive rhetoric and aggressive deeds in Iraq. They have killed, as I said, Iraqi citizens, either right across the border in Syria or right across the border in Iraq. But no matter what it was, they have struck Iraqi targets de facto. So when Iran says, and a lot of sources in Iraq as well say that this is an attack that is unjustifiable and an attack that de facto helps terrorist organizations, this is definitely true. There are now sources in Iraq that are saying that by targeting the border areas, the Americans have opened the border for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists to come from northeastern Syria back into Iraq. Which is interesting, because a lot of these terrorists were originally active in Iraq and then went to Syria during the Syrian civil war, of course, when during the height of the flare-up of the violence in Syria back in, let's say, 2013, 14, and 15. A lot of these people went to Syria in order to massacre and terrorize the population there on behalf of the Americans, on behalf of the Western coalition, and of the so-called, you know, Syrian, what was it, the Syrian National Army, Syrian Free Syrian Army, and things like that. And now that they are gradually losing ground in Syria again, some of these people are being redeployed, of course, underground and under cover of U.S. protection, redeployed in Iraq, because this insurgency is still ongoing, as indeed has been said. Daesh has been defeated as a political entity, as an entity that actually controlled a significant amount of territory, but is still continuing as a standard terrorist organization comparable to Al-Qaeda. And one of the reasons why they keep on doing this is that the Americans keep on, in fact, supporting them. We know there are numerous reports already from years and years ago of Daesh terrorists surrendering, quote-unquote, to the coalition forces led by the Americans in Syria and being granted de facto amnesty and airlifted back into Iraq. Of course, completely without asking the permission of Baghdad. And this is one of the things that is really unjustifiable and really disgusting about this entire situation, is that so many things are happening in Iraq without the Iraqis having been asked anything. You have certain Kurdish fighters coming in from the Kurdish regions of Turkey. You have the Turks invading Iraq in order to fight those Kurdish forces, again without asking the Iraqis. You have Daesh forces being trafficked into Iraq and then bombed by U.S. forces without, you know, talking to the Iraqi government itself. And this is something that I think when the Islamic Republic of Iran speaks out against this, they are often accused of, let's say, meddling in Iraqi affairs. But in fact, what I think what Iran is doing is basically just standing up for the national sovereignty of their neighboring state, of the Republic of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the American actions in Iraq have time and time again caused a massive destabilization, especially in the border areas, especially in the oil-rich areas, and have continued this U.S. policy of occupation, destruction, and balkanization.
Right.
That they have been doing for decades across the West and Asia. So I think Iran definitely has a very good point when they're saying that this is a massive handout that is being given to terrorists across the region.
Elijah McNair, just a thought here. Maybe the whole game plan behind the U.S. When it does attack, for example, what it did with Syria on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and for its presence there in Iraq, is to, in their viewpoints and in their eyes, trying to cut off any relationship that Iran has with Iraq and in turn with Syria. We know that Israel, obviously staunch U.S. ally, keeps bombing Syria, and we know that U.S. presence in Iraq creates this instability, and therefore it wants these two countries, Iraq and Syria, to turn their backs against Iran. Could that be a mentality of the U.S. behind any moves that they make in terms of their presence or any actions that they take?
That's one of the points and one of the major points. So we see the American presence in northeast Syria has been used as a base for Israelis to come and use the military airport there and to bomb Syria from the static position of the Americans on the border. And we saw the Israelis using the U.S. facilities by going and bombing the Iraqi security forces warehouses and assassinating commanders of Hashd al-Sha'bi while traveling between Baghdad and the borders. And also we see the presence of the Americans on a Tanf crossing, a road that I've done endlessly. That's a very short road between Damascus and Baghdad. And that road on the borders, the Americans have established the very large base, military base, for which reason there's no reason for them to be there at the exception of blocking the commerce. And one of the things that the Americans went completely mad about is when General Qasem Soleimani went to Deir ez-Zor and liberated Al-Qaim and freed the border between Iraq and Syria before the arrival of the Americans that had the intention to jump from Tanf to Al-Qaim and close that border to cut off Syria completely from Iraq. And that was one of the main reasons why the Americans are bombing always in that area. And I would like to add, very important, the Prime Minister of Iraq, Mustafa Kazemi, sent a delegation 2 days ago to the borders to make sure that the bombing was on the Iraqi side, not on the Syrian side. And to his discovery, it was confirmed on the Iraqi. That means the Americans lied to him. And even if they did, he was not up to the standard of a prime minister to stand up to the Americans and condemn their action against his own military forces because he is the commander-in-chief. So the Americans not only violate Iraq's sovereignty, but they also lie to the prime minister and go and attack the borders to make sure that Syria is going to be completely crippled economically. And this is why they have imposed also the Caesar Act sanctions on the Syrian population to starve the population. And these sanctions always are used against the population in Venezuela, in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon.
Final question goes to you, Bert Jonkers. We had one of the Democratic representatives say, we quote, "We ran on ending wars, not escalating conflicts in the Middle East. Our foreign policy needs to be rooted in diplomacy and the rule of law, not retaliatory airstrikes without the authorization of Congress." This is what Biden did. This is the reaction it got. Do you think that the U.S. is going to escalate its actions militarily now that we have seen this attack take place on Ain al-Assad?
Well, in this regard, I prefer staying somewhat optimistic. When analyzing a similar situation recently, being the one in Yemen, which is, of course, even much worse than the situation that is happening, unfortunately, in Syria and Iraq, I have bumped on that on the similar issue that there's a growing anti-war movement now in the United States. It's not as big as the anti-war movement was in the beginning of when the Iraq War was going on, the anti-war movement then, but it's something that is growing. And what is hopeful, of course, with certain reservations, with certain grains of salt, of course, to take it with for anything an American politician says. But what is sort of hopeful is that there are more and more people who refuse to just take the word of the president, take the word of this and that politician for it, and then just settle down and hope that it will happen. We see people on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and especially Democrats, now criticizing Joe Biden and saying this is not what we voted for, we want out, it is time to really get out of these undeclared wars. So I hope that this will indeed continue and that this anti-war movement will eventually bear fruit.
Thank you for that, Brent Yonkers, historian and journalist. And thank you very much, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kazimiya, and then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16, and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, which is an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding philosophers, thinkers and jurists of the Islamic nation all across the world. And with me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom. We want to discuss the ideas and the thoughts of one of the most outstanding Shia jurists and philosophers, Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. Before anything, let me say salam, Dr. Azadeh. Assalamu alaikum to you. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. So, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, the exiled Shia jurist, thinker, and also the socio-political activist of contemporary Iraq, is the outstanding figure with whom we are concerned in this new series of the program, The Teacher. In our previous discussions, we talked about a short biography of him. We can say some of his most important socio-political and cultural activities in the country, Iraq, how he was martyred by the Basque regime, and also we talked about his ideas on Islamic economics, especially the book Iqtisaduna, or Our Economics. We also talked about the concept of Haqqut Ta'a in his idea, or the right of obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the most outstanding, we can say, theories, or it's better to say, we can say, fields of research of Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr was developed and was presented in his outstanding book, Iqtisaduna. In that book, he presents a very beautiful concept which shows the dynamic nature of the religion of Islam and Islamic jurisprudence, and that is topic of Mantaqat al-Faraq. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. Ayatollah Shaheed Sadr, Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, is also known with the theory, I mean Mantaqat al-Faraq. What is Mantaqat al-Faraq exactly? And let's start with a definition, a primary definition on that, and then we'll get to its application in today's life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In regards to the idea of Mandaqat al-Faraq, the terminology which he used and the idea which he put forward, if we talk about the definition of it, literally we can translate like Mantaqa means an area or a space area. Faraq means, Faraq has come from the void or vacuum. mm-hmm. or maybe it's a free area.
Free
okay. area.
Yes.
Technically, we can say it's a free area, Mantaqatul Faragh.
Yes.
What does it mean? It means like when he is putting forward this idea in the Islamic economics, he is basically referring to that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given a free hand to the ruler of the Islamic, we can say, territory or ummah,
mm-hmm.
that in some cases where there is no rulings about something, about a specific, we can say, like action or about a decision which they wanted to make,
that's right.
there he has a free hand from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay.
That he can bring a new rule
mm-hmm.
according to the situation
that's
and the
right.
scenario
okay.
that is happening. But obviously there are some conditions as well.
Okay.
So when we're talking about Mantaqatul Faragh, basically we are talking about a ruler, an Islamic ruler,
mm-hmm.
in a specific condition where there is no ruling from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
He is given a free hand
okay.
that on the basis of the current situation
That's
that
right.
he is facing,
mm-hmm.
he can make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that decisions can be, for example, like it is halal to do, it is haram to
okay.
do, something
it's
like this.
It's based on the decisions that might. So in order to simplify it is a scope or domain of the, we can say, the idea and the meanings and the thoughts in which the Islamic ruler of the land has freedom in order to issue, for example, a ruling or
yes.
or his own deductions based on the necessities of the day, isn't it?
Yes.
That's all right.
But the point is there shouldn't be any rulings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Uh-huh.
In the absence of the ruling
okay.
of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
okay.
because, you know, when we're talking about the rulings, and when we say like Islam is a religion which remains till Qiyamah, Allah has made some rules clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And he has given a part, a free hand to the ruler as well.
That's all right.
So that he can obviously run the government that
okay.
he has on the basis of the knowledge that he has and the power which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given
okay.
to him. So Mantaqatul Faragh is one of the powers that is given to the ruler by
That's
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You know, the power which is given. So Dr. Rezazadeh, what's your take on that, brother? In fact, the definition, I think, was correct. They were given by Sayyid Mohsen
yes.
Naqvi. But the case is that Islam is a complete and comprehensive religion,
yeah.
okay?
Yeah.
So and the rulings are issued. So why Mantaqatul Faragh must be given to an Islamic ruler or ruler of a Muslim land in order to issue, for example, a new ruling regarding the conditions and the circumstances of his
yes.
day.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, the whole question goes back to the question of the domain of the Islamic ruling, and in specific, the domain of Islamic economy.
That's right.
And Shahid Saad, when he talks about this in his book, he clearly classifies, let's say, Islamic economic system
mm-hmm.
into two different types.
Okay.
And we can say that that's a general classification that we can say about anything, all the rulings in Islam. And he says that one part of the rulings that we have in Islam are the fixed parts, rulings that have been issued by the Prophet. They have been revealed to the Prophet
mm-hmm.
and they will stay the same until the Day of Judgment.
That's right.
There are many rulings that
yes.
you are familiar with.
Yes.
For example, the rulings of the worships and, you
yes.
know, many
and the
other
obligations,
examples,
the
obligations
matters,
and
right.
prohibitions
okay.
and the law. But still, there is a part of Islamic system, Islamic school of thought
mm-hmm.
that includes a type of freedom for the ruler, a jurist ruler who knows the basics and who knows the foundational rulings and the principles. Based on those principles, he has. So this freedom is not an absolute freedom.
That's right.
It's a type of freedom which is necessary and is part of the Islamic school, is part of the Islamic system,
mm-hmm.
in order to give this system a type of flexibility
okay, very
to
good.
Be applicable in all the times and in all the places.
And adjustable to all the
yeah,
conditions.
Yeah, because of the new developments that
okay.
happen for the humankind.
Okay.
I mean, this is something that is a nature of
yeah,
the humanity,
natural.
That
okay.
they are, that they progress, they develop, and many new things emerge.
Mm-hmm.
So there must be new answers to the new questions.
That's all right.
We cannot just give the old answers to the new questions.
That's
so
all right.
This needs a system.
And I think the Shia system of fiqh,
yes,
has this potential,
yes,
I mean, in order to answer the new questions that are put. But also I think the role of the jurist and the faqih itself is very important,
yeah,
over here.
So the whole idea is not something that did not exist in the,
yes,
Islamic. It definitely,
yes,
existed, especially before Shahid Saad, for example, Ayatollah Naimi, he,
yes,
talked about this concept. But what Shahid Saad did, he really clarified it and he named it in a very clear way. And also he gave the specifics of this,
yes,
concept.
Yes.
And mainly he brought the idea of Mantaqatul Faragh, the free area,
mm-hmm,
to the Islamic economic system.
In order to remind our dear listeners, I might say that we discussed it before, that Shahid Assad by Islamic economics is talking about the kind of maktab, or a school of thought,
yes,
which will cover not only economics, but also all the other aspects of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book Iqtisaduna, we can say different dimensions of the life of the Muslims are covered.
Yes.
So in here, if you are talking about Iqtisad or Iqtisaduna, we do not necessarily mean it is only limited to Iqtisadi or economic,
yes,
matters.
Yes, yes.
And this,
yes,
is
it's
very
it's
important.
It's much more general.
Yes.
Another thing that Shahid Saad mentioned is that even at the time of the Prophet, about the Prophet himself,
yes,
he had two different aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he issued the, you know, the rulings based on the revelation, as I said.
That's right.
And sometimes he was actually using the other aspect of himself, which was the ruler of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, he considered the situations. That, and some of the rulings that he did was not necessarily, you know, let's say, rulings that come out of
That's
revelation.
Right.
They were his own ijtihad somehow.
Okay. And this is also, Said Mohsen Naqvi, I think, is very much applicable when we are passing live at the time of the major occultation of Imam al-Mahdi. I mean, as the fuqaha or wali faqih, we can say, who has the a very specific and a special role in the society, comes to the scene, and in this we can say Ghaybat al-Kubra, this idea and this theory of Shahid Assad, I mean, Mantaqat al-Faragh, can very much help the fuqaha in order to apply Islamic rulings in the Muslim lands today, isn't it?
Well, that's true, and one thing we need to remember, when Shahid Saad is talking about Mantaqat al-Faragh, he is basically putting forward this idea at the time of occultation.
Uh-huh.
Because he said at the time when Imam is there, Imam is a hujjah, because he's the,
yes,
the exact authority which,
yes,
has been introduced by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
So there is no doubt in the orders of Imam. So basically if Imam,
okay,
makes a rule,
okay,
or he introduces a rule, it is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Although, as you said, Imam, like the Prophet, might act according to Mantaqat al-Faragh,
yes,
himself,
yes,
too.
But
okay,
obviously we don't have any doubts in that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Being the Muslim Ummah, being a Muslim, I don't have any doubt when,
yes,
Imam says something,
yes,
or the Prophet says something.
Yes.
Because they are the direct authority of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala upon,
okay,
us. Allah,
yes,
has introduced them.
Yes.
The problem occurs where a representative of Imam, for example, a mujtahid or marja,
mm-hmm,
comes and he issues a fatwa.
Mm-hmm.
Is this applicable on me or not?
That's right.
Especially when he is a ruler. Now, the point is that in an Islamic country, there might be many maraje,
yes,
many mujtahids,
yes,
highly esteemed scholars,
yes,
who give fatwa.
Yes.
And on top of them, there is a wali faqih.
Yes.
Now, who to see and who to obey? At that point,
okay.
For example, in a specific stance, my mujtahid gives a fatwa,
which is different okay,
from the order that the wali faqih has given.
Okay,
what should I do?
Mm-hmm.
Now here, Mantaqat al-Faragh comes and says, because wali faqih is the ruler of the Muslim governorship,
okay,
and he has been given this free hand from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, therefore the mujtahid also himself, who has given the fatwa, should obey this wali faqih.
Okay.
In order to have discipline in the society.
In the society, okay.
Obviously, the main job of the ruler, mm-hmm, wali faqih, or the person who is governing, ruling the Muslim Ummah,
yes,
as a wali faqih, and this is very important, Dr. Ali Reza Zadeh has mentioned, like a ruler, mujtahid, marja ruler.
Yes.
This word marja we should,
yes,
not forget. We are not talking about any ruler who is ruling,
okay,
the Muslim
or
Ummah.
Or any marja.
or any marja.
It's better to say any marja. Yes. We are talking about
it's
the ruler.
It's not about any marja. Uh-huh. Also, it is not about any ruler. There are many Muslim countries at the moment.
Okay.
There are many Muslim rulers. We are talking about a ruler who is marja himself, mm-hmm. who is waliya faqih, who is at the state of the, at the status of the, we can say like waliya faqih.
Yeah.
It's for him.
Yeah. At he has time. The power of deductions.
Yes. Now.
He has the mastery over different aspects of the society.
So there is a difference between the orders that the waliya faqih gives and the fatwa that the mujtahid gives.
Mujtahid.
For example, maybe a waliya faqih himself is a mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
When he gives a fatwa, his fatwa is obligation for his, like, it's obligatory for the muqalladin only.
That's all right.
The followers.
That's all right.
Not for the whole Muslim ummah.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever he gives an order on the basis of being waliya faqih, it is upon everyone to basically observe and to obey him.
Okay, thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh. There is still a lot to say about the idea of Mantaqatul Faragh and its relation to today's world. We can say some of the Muslim scholars have compared it with the theory of Masaleh Mursaleh in the, we can say, in the Sunni school of Saad. And as Dr. Reza Zadeh said, the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Naini has tackled this issue in his book Tanbihul Ummah and Tanzihul Millah, which is a very nice book. Also, some say that Sheikh Al-Ansari has also presented this idea. And Shahid Assad, in order to organize and systematize this idea, we can say, has presented in his book Iqtisaduna. It was very kind of you. Inshallah, we'll continue our discussion on Mantaqatul Faragh in an upcoming session of the program. And thank you very much, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanil.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Reporters.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gadza, even the heart of occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside the, inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, like in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. it doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just need block it either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Less than 10% of the EU's inhabitants have so far been given a COVID-19 vaccine. This is minuscule when compared to the progress made in the bloc's closest allies, the UK and US. Vaccine producers have been grilled in the European Parliament. AstraZeneca is accused of not fulfilling contracts it signed with the EU.
How is it possible that you had no clue of your production capacity? Because what has happened is not a minor setback, it's a huge failure.
AstraZeneca is providing 60% fewer doses to the EU in the first quarter of the year than promised.
How does AstraZeneca explain the export of vaccine produced in the EU to the UK, but at the same time the company is not willing to ship vaccine from the production site in the UK to the EU?
The firm is promising to ramp up production. It says delays happen because hundreds of ingredients are required to make the vaccine.
What is made in the EU, as I said before, overwhelmingly stays in the EU, including the site in the Netherlands that was originally reserved by the UK.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was developed by Germany, but the EU signed supply contracts 4 months after the UK.
EU countries such as Hungary, Austria and Denmark are availing of vaccines from China, Russia and Israel. This shows divisions are growing within the bloc as nations break away from the European Commission's vaccination strategy.
EU citizens are growing more impatient by the day as they witness the health and economic impacts of the pandemic.
If EU would be able to press more intensively on the producers or pharmaceutical companies producing the vaccines, that would be wonderful.
Of course, this is the solution. Must be quicker because, you know, within 2 months, the summer will begin.
The European Medicines Agency, or EMA, is the EU institution that approves vaccines in the bloc. Producers were asked to comment on the EMA's seemingly slow approval record.
All of the data that goes to support the application for approval in the UK is actually being shared with the EMA.
One angry lawmaker suggested the only thing not delayed are the profits being raked in by pharmaceutical giants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic elite relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship. And I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink, and with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned that the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. Homolezgi Fiena.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak. From massive spending to protect jobs.
Today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made Chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young Chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
And the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
Yeah, a lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment. It's literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then, there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Furuza, London.
Prisoners' rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners and demanded an end to Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. Some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers.
Israel has demonstrated zero accountability and acts with impunity because it enjoys the full support of the United States. Israel considers itself as an entity that is above international law. Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the Palestinian people, especially against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as around 400 of them are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Palestinian prisoners are suffering because of medical negligence as well as administrative detention in Israeli prisons, and their situation became much worse during the coronavirus pandemic. We call on international organizations to exert real pressure on Israel in order to stop its illegal and inhumane practices against Palestinian prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons. Dozens of prisoners suffer from cancer and other life-threatening diseases.
The suffering of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons is unprecedented. They're being oppressed on a daily basis, and the Israeli regime is systematically killing the prisoners by denying them proper medical care. We're here today to let the whole world know that we're standing with the prisoners.
Palestinian inmates are more vulnerable now with the absence of vital preventive measures during the coronavirus pandemic.
Experts say that the protection Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to continue to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's defense ministry has delivered 9 military and transportation planes, 10 choppers, and tens of engines repaired at Iran Aviation Industries Organization to the Iranian Armed Forces. Iranian specialists have overhauled 9 jet fighters, including F-4, F-14, F-27, and Mirage types, as well as transportation types of planes, including C-130, 707, and 747. The types of the 10 overhauled helicopters range from 204 and 205 to 212 and 214, which have applications in combat and rescue operations. The engines overhauled include turbojet, turbofan, and turboshaft types.
The enemy was in vain efforts to defeat Iran through sanctions and restrictions on buying military equipment. But the country conquered the enemy by reliance on indigenous capability, building military equipment, and optimizing defense equipment. Iran's successful strategy has defeated the enemy's maximum pressure policy.
Iran has utilized capacities of domestic knowledge-based companies in overhauling and repairing the helicopters and planes.
The Air Force of the Islamic Republic of Iran is a dynamic, innovative, and self-sufficient sector, which is completely reliable for operational purposes. The delivery of several planes and helicopters to the force indicates the creativity of our experts, with which we have optimized and upgraded our equipment. We will defend our country's borders under all conditions in the best way.
In recent years, Iran has made great strides in the defense sector and become self-sufficient in producing essential military hardware and defense systems. Iran has repeatedly made it clear that its military might is merely defensive and that it poses no threat to other countries.
Iran says at a time of sanctions, overhauling light, semi-heavy, and heavy military equipment
as the most cost-effective and safest way to boost the country's defensive capabilities. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
One year has passed from a meeting in the Qatari capital, Doha, where the US and Taliban representatives inked a deal to put an end to the decades-long misery of the Afghan nation by reaching an agreement to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. The release of 5,000 Taliban inmates, the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban's approval of a ceasefire were the main parts of the US-Taliban deal. The prisoners were released, but the other two commitments have not been fulfilled yet. Soon after the US-Taliban deal was signed, the first round of intra-Afghan talks kicked off in Doha. This once again ruined the dreams of Afghans as it failed to bring peace. Now, Afghan officials not only warned the Taliban to either approve a lasting peace or get ready to be killed by Afghan armed troops, but blamed the international community for depriving Afghans of their fundamental right, that is peace.
The international community has deprived a great nation, which has a great history and bright civilization, of one of their fundamental rights, that is peace. This is unacceptable. We want a lasting peace that should be achieved via our armed troops' power and will of the nation.
The Afghan peace process is facing some key obstacles, including foreign interference. But the bitter fact is that the main victims of war are innocent civilians. Based on an annual report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission on humanitarian conditions for Afghan children, nearly 6,000 civilians, including more than 2,000 children, were killed in 2020 due to war and violence in Afghanistan.
The total number of civilian casualties recorded by Independent Human Rights Commission over the last year is 5,800. 2,019 of them are children. That is why we want all warring sides to pay respect to civilian lives.
Let's not forget that the new U.S. administration has announced Washington is going to review the U.S.-Taliban deal. The declaration was welcomed by the Afghan government, but the Taliban urgently reacted and blamed the U.S. for seeking a pretext to stay in Afghanistan further. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela might be about to break relations with the Kingdom of Spain after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced he would review relations of all kinds with the European country due to what he calls their improper and disrespectful actions against Venezuela. Experts say that Spain, among members of the European Union, is regarded as the most important influence in the European policy toward the nations of Latin America. In the light of rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced recent hostile actions from the Spanish government of Pedro Sanchez, including the Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez, who last Saturday visited the border between Colombia and Venezuela and criticized the situation of Venezuelan migrants in the zone. The visit by the top Spaniard diplomat in Colombia was strongly decried by Maduro, saying that Spain must stay away from his country's internal issues.
I condemn Spain's meddling actions. Such a mistaken conduct will be punished by my administration.
Meanwhile, on the opposition side, many backed the Spanish move, alleging the European country must intervene in Venezuela's problems.
Spain's speaking in favor of Venezuelan migrants who flee our homeland due to Maduro's failed regime.
However, Venezuelan officials insist the Spanish move is politically motivated and therefore will not be tolerated.
Spain and the European Union must rectify their hostile political stance on Venezuela, or else relations will break up.
Maduro has remarked that relations with Spain in all areas will be fully examined by him, as the Spanish meddling in Venezuela's affairs is unacceptable. He blames Madrid over imitating the U.S. hostility and claims Venezuela will respond accordingly. Associated Press.
the limelight.